Welcome to the Climate Conscious Podcast, where we discuss all things sustainable. I'm your host, Duval Bazzi, and joining me today is James Elsmore. Hi, James. How are you?
All good here in cold and rainy England. Wish I was back in the Caribbean, but might be a while until that happens. I'm not sure when we're going to be able to travel again.
And we've been having some showers ourselves.
Yeah, but it's probably a bit warmer there. It feels like the middle of winter here.
Oh my. James Elsmore is an award-winning social entrepreneur focused on small islands and sustainable development. He is the founder of Island Innovation, a consulting agency, and co-founder of Solar Head of State, an international nonprofit. James specializes in the implementation of sustainable development goals for small island developing states, such as the Caribbean and Pacific Islands. Originally from the UK, James has lived, worked, and traveled in over 60 countries. So James, you describe yourself as a digital nomad, and you are really onto something there, because the current pandemic has highlighted the importance of virtual connections and being location independent.
It's an interesting thing on that, because so many people are now working from home that I think there's going to be a long-term change there. A lot of companies now encouraging people to work from home, and they realize they can do things cheaper without needing to have an office and things. So we'll see. Maybe it will lead, all of this under the pandemic will lead to a long-term change.
Long before the physical distancing imposed by the global pandemic, you set out to build digital bridges between sustainable islands. What inspired you to embark on this route?
Well, I think for me, the idea of this was, I was very lucky that when I was studying, I had the opportunity to do research in the Pacific Islands. I also have an energy background, particularly focused on renewables. And so I was very lucky to visit the islands of Niue, Samoa, Fiji, and Tuvalu in the Pacific, in addition to New Zealand. And do a research project where I met with stakeholders and looked at approaches to renewable energy in those countries. And then I came back at the time I was living in the US, and I came back and then after that started to experience and have the experience of working in the Caribbean, and worked in the Caribbean for several years, and saw the similarities and differences between those two regions. Obviously, the Pacific and Caribbean are about as far away from each other as you can get, but there was a lot of parallels. So the obvious one is the high cost of energy. Well, I know Trinidad's an exception, but most of the Caribbean has very expensive electricity, as does the Pacific, a dependency on imported diesel, and other things like, for example, difficulties in disposing of plastic waste, or dependency or a need to reform tourism. All of these things are very similar. And then I came back to the UK, where I'm from, and was working in the islands of Scotland. And actually, I did my master's, believe it or not, in island studies at a university on one of the Scottish islands. And what was really interesting to me was how similar the conversations in Scotland and the Scottish islands were to those that I'd been hearing in the Caribbean. A need to retain talent, as so many people left and migrated away from the islands, all the ones I mentioned with energy, sustainable waste, etc., and a need to kind of rethink those economies, but also the interconnectedness of all of the issues. You can't talk about water or energy without talking about agriculture and tourism. And all of those issues just really interrelate with each other. So that was kind of the idea. And I saw an opportunity to use internet connections, which have obviously, even in the last 10 years, just mushroomed and spiraled in terms of their the quality of internet connections, to help those islands, whether they're in the Caribbean or Scotland or the Pacific, share information about what's working, what doesn't work, and maybe inspire change and cooperation between them.
So, I mean, although you grew up in the UK on a farm, you are truly an island guy.
I'm honored to hear that from you.
So you created a platform for sharing ideas and good practices and solutions for sustainability, The Island Innovation Summit, which is now in its second year, is a 100% online, completely free, zero carbon conference. And it focuses on the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals. Now, this is a very impressive endeavor. What has been the impact of this event?
Yeah, so the first one was last year. And at the time, I had no idea how important virtual events would be the following year, which is a kind of an interesting development in itself. But obviously, I saw the value beyond just the pandemic. I saw the value in building these bridges and connecting these islands and looking for opportunities to do that. And I think, you know, the power of using the internet is that you can obviously get people in the same room. I mean, I was fortunate enough to have been to the United Nations and been to various talks and meetings. And I found that, you know, those were incredible, but often the people who were on the ground kind of doing the work didn't have access to them, whether it was just because of the visas or the distance or simply the cost of getting there. And so for me, this was like a way of democratizing and allowing people, whether they're the minister or whether they're planting trees in their community and everyone in between, that they all have their role and they all have their importance and help bring those connections together. But obviously this year now, there's a renewed importance for virtual events. And I think, you know, probably a lot of people are a bit fed up of Zoom for obvious reasons. But at the same time, there's, I think, been a growing awareness of the opportunity that these technologies can bring us. And so what I'm hoping is that moving into the future, there will be more kind of appreciation for the fact that these can allow people to participate. And distance is an obvious one, but also things like often people might not be able to travel because they're a single parent and they can't get childcare, or because they have a disability, or obviously because of financial reasons. And so I'm hoping this will kind of allow more people to participate in these global conversations.
Can you imagine what the experience of the pandemic would have been like without these virtual connections that we have been able to utilize?
No, I can't even imagine.
James, you raised some important points with regards to the power of the internet to facilitate participation. Some might say that there are numerous conferences, conventions, treaties, you know, a lot of talk about sustainability and sustainable development, but not enough action. How would you respond to that?
I agree. It's true. there's so much talk, and and that's partly because it's easier to talk than do action and get things doing. And I acknowledge that. And you know, I, as much as I want to help create action on the ground, I only have so many hours in the day and there's a limitation, right? So no, I think I would agree. I think there's all of these different meetings and talk, but I think why I still see the value in the Virtual Island Summit and the work that we're doing is because, like I mentioned, you can reach that broader audience, you can reach more people and involve them. And as you're one of our ambassadors, you know that we have this kind of group, and you can engage with people from places like Guam or Fiji or Mauritius and see the work that they're doing on their islands. And it's already sparked a lot of useful conversations and inspired a lot of action. And I think talking is important. Information is important. We can't do things unless we have the information. And the reason why I don't see the Virtual Island Summit as just another conference is because we have such a diversity of people attending. To be honest, I don't know of any other conference that has so many different islands featured, and also the diversity of academics, but also private sector, governments, and NGOs. You know, I've often been to physical events, let's say on the energy sector, where it's all private sector or all academics. And sometimes that's really frustrating because you say, well, these people are working on the same issue, but they're living on different planets and they're working on completely different things. And so I think, as well as digital bridges between islands, part of this is also bridges between sectors and helping these different sectors understand each other, which I think will lead to action. But yes, I mean, I'm always looking for ways to translate talk into action. That's clearly an important part of it.
So you enlisted the support of Ireland ambassadors, and I think that is such a genius idea because you were able to bring together over 100 Ireland communities. What has been key to getting the Ireland ambassador program working and bearing fruit?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about the ambassador program. It's a really fun network of people. There's been a lot of enthusiastic individuals. And a lot of this has been around networking and creating a platform for our island ambassadors to talk to each other. Our original plan with the island ambassadors had been to help have them to take a role on organizing physical events and meetups. So all of our kind of virtual event could also have physical components of it where people could meet in person on their island. For obvious reasons, it didn't quite happen like that, but I'm still hoping that next year we can incorporate that idea when it becomes more practical to have meetings of people in person. But we've also been organizing virtual meetings and kind of having everyone come together. And I think now what we're interested, we had a really good conversation this morning, actually, about how potentially we can help other ambassadors can put spotlights on work happening on other islands and then help use that conversation to spark discussion on how, let's say, ideas from Mauritius or from Malta could then be applied in, say, Trinidad or vice versa. And so I'm hoping there's a good opportunity there, but also it's a way for us to, this summit on a certain level is very global, which can make it seem very distant. And so what we want to make sure we're doing, again, part of this action component that you mentioned before, is help people try and translate what's happening on the global level to the conversation on the ground in their community.
I'm really excited to be a part of the Ireland Ambassador Network. And I was very pleased to see that there are at least 9 ambassadors from Trinidad and Tobago. Because as you know, we are, I guess, in the early stages of our sustainability transition.
I was just going to say on that, I was really happy that Trinidad has actually the most ambassadors out of any country in the network,
that so?
Which is fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah, which is interesting, right? But and originally we had thought of limiting it to having one ambassador per country, but then we had so many amazing applications, it was so hard to say no, and we thought actually it's better to create this community. So I'm glad you said that, because we wanted to kind of keep it inclusive and have those people. And especially for Trinidad, which has always been interesting that the conversation in Trinidad is quite different than from the rest of the Caribbean because of the oil industry and the history there. But I've also noticed in the past few years kind of a lot of interest from Trinidad and from Trinis to participate in these kind of sustainability conversations. So the interest is definitely there. And I guess another reason why, you know, having the conversations is kind of a needed precursor to help create action.
I started this podcast because I wanted to help make sustainability mainstream. I wanted it to become, you know, a natural part of any conversation, then for it to translate into meaningful action. I can definitely say the interest is there based on the feedback that I've been getting on the podcast. You mentioned earlier that, you know, although islands would have their peculiar issues, there are lots of parallels. And so there would be great value in terms of tapping into this network, not just within the Caribbean region, but with islands across the globe. So James, yeah, you co-founded Solar Head of State, and you've been working to raise awareness of renewable energy through high-profile solar installations on government buildings. Can you tell us a bit about this initiative?
Yeah, so Solar Head of State was the nonprofit that I started before I started Island Innovation, which is a company. And the reason for doing that, I mean, I was involved with a campaign before that. So Solar Head of State did exist before me. And I kind of joined and started the campaign really focused on islands and looking at the Caribbean. And also the Pacific. And so we have done installations on the Presidential Palace in the Maldives, on the Governor General's residence in St. Lucia, and the Office of the Prime Minister in Jamaica. and in collaboration with those with those governments. And sometimes, you know, the obvious criticism there is, well, why are you focused on the leaders and why not focus on schools and hospitals, which is a fair point. But obviously all of these buildings are owned by the government. So any savings on those projects do go to the government as a whole and benefit the taxpayer. But I think more importantly, there is kind of a leadership argument needed. So, you know, if you have countries like St. Lucia that are calling out the big, and the Maldives that are calling out the big polluters for their emissions, then also that needs to be complemented by kind of leadership by example. And so I think obviously small island developing states, SIDS countries, are very small emitters in the grand scheme of things. You know, they're a tiny percentage of global emissions, even altogether, compared to places like China and India, Europe and the US.
Yeah.
But what they do have is this kind of power of leading by example. And obviously for most of them, it also makes economic sense to use renewables more. But also there's a powerful statement in being able to say, well, we can do it, therefore other countries too. And that was often used by the SIDS countries at the COPs and the Paris Agreement, for example. And so we were playing our small part in that to say, okay, we think that every energy ministry or every government building should have solar on as kind of a statement of intention for those governments. And sure, it's probably a small percentage of the global needs. You know, I'm not saying it solves a problem, but it sends a powerful message. And a lot of this, you know, yes, we need action, but action happens through kind of changing the narrative and through the conversations. And so we really wanted to kind of use these small installations to help drive a dialogue within those countries, but also put the spotlight on what was happening in those countries on the global perspective. And so, for example, in Jamaica, when we installed solar on the office of the Prime Minister, that was also when the Prime Minister announced his goal for 50% renewable energy for Jamaica at the same time. And it was a small kind of symbol of that long-term goal, which is going to be hard to reach, but to me makes a lot of sense for purely economic reasons, let alone the additional environmental benefits.
Yeah, I think it's important what you're doing in terms of working with governments and sending that powerful message, because a lot of times one of the main barriers to deploying sustainable energy is the political will.
Definitely. And all of these things kind of work together and it takes time. But by I and sometimes, you know, symbols are not everything. But by having even a little thing, you imagine if the ministers and the prime minister are seeing solar panels every day and you have them outside of government buildings, that in itself is a powerful reminder. And, you know, I think we need to attack this issue from all sides. No one thing is going to do this. And for example, in the Caribbean, I think it's also on institutions like UWE, like the University of the West Indies. They have just as much of a role in it wouldn't be amazing if the UWE campuses all took it upon themselves to also become 100% renewables or put goals in place to do that as well, because the vast majority of future leaders in the Caribbean go through those institutions. So I think thinking about that role that leadership has in changing the existing system is really important. And it's not just political leadership of women, leadership of youth, leadership from other types of institutions like the private sector as well. They all play a role.
Have you looked at climate change from a gendered lens?
Yeah, it's definitely something we've discussed. Are you thinking more about adaptation or mitigation? What angle within that? Because there's a number of different directions you could go, right, even under the gender.
So I'm thinking in terms of adaptation, because as we know, climate change really intensifies vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And you can have vulnerable countries, but within that, you will have even more vulnerable subsets or sectors. And I found that in some regions, you know, women and girls bear an even heavier burden of climate impacts in terms of displacement, loss of income, you know, and even health impacts. So,
right.
Because we tend to look at it very broadly from a national perspective. But I think there are some intricacies that need to be explored as it pertains to women and girls.
No, I definitely agree. And I think that was a really good way of explaining it, that vulnerabilities are intensified by climate change. I'm just trying to remember, there was some interesting research that came out about this, and there were some really good numbers, but it was talking about kind of the financial impact on women of climate change. And on a number of levels that this happens. I mean, and not to take the focus off gender necessarily, but this obviously applies across the board when we're thinking about kind of disenfranchised groups or vulnerable groups. In some cases, for example, thinking about refugees and people who are undocumented in a country. We actually saw that in Bahamas after the hurricane hit. There's a large number of Haitian migrants, many of whom were there without documentation, living in Bahamas. And so that meant that after this hit, after the hurricane hit, they were not able to access government services all the time. Mm-hmm. They were not prioritized against citizens. And in some cases, there was never any actual knowledge of how many people passed away and how many people were lost in that. So there's all of these different vulnerabilities, I think, are important to consider when talking about climate change. And you could easily expand that in certain countries. You know, you see that in the US, often minority groups, racial minority groups, often live in areas that are more vulnerable because they're the cheaper areas. And if they're disenfranchised financially, that can have these spin-off effects. So there's been a lot of talk in cities like Miami about climate gentrification, the idea that the higher ground in Miami has become very expensive. And so therefore, poorer people are being forced into the lower areas, which are most vulnerable. And you saw that in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit, that the most mm-hmm. vulnerable parts of the city were those home to African Americans. And the list goes on for those types of conversations. So I didn't want to take that away from the gender conversation, but I just wanted to give some other angles on it as well.
Climate change is so complex. There are so many layers. It's fascinating and terrifying at the same time. And would you believe that there's an established link between climate change and human trafficking and modern day slavery? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, you know, so mind blowing. It comes back to, you know, looking at the vulnerable and disenfranchised right. groups.
A really interesting, and on the same topic, I read a really interesting paper about this from the Pacific Islands, talking about LGBT people after the cyclone hit Fiji last year. And you might think at first, well, why would an LGBT person be more impacted by climate change? And it wasn't necessarily that they were worse affected by the hurricane, but what happened was, because of the discrimination against that community, they, in the recovery process, were less likely to have access to, for example, the homes that were made for new people. There was this kind of discrimination that existed within the government system or from the response community that meant that they did not necessarily have access to the resources that were being provided because they were being discriminated against. So it's not necessarily that the hurricane hits those people more, but then the human existing discrimination or existing kind of biases that we have in societies are then amplified, as you say.
Yeah, certainly. As I said, it's fascinating and terrifying all at once.
Yeah, very complicated issues.
I think the level of complexity might deter persons from trying to address it, but whatever contribution you can make as an individual, as part of an organization, even in your household. So, for example, I started a compost heap as one of my contributions towards minimizing the impact on the planet.
And I think it's important as well that we remember that no one's perfect. We shouldn't have our ambitions kind of thwarted by perfection, because if we seek to only be perfect, then we're always going to fail. And so, you know, I find this frustrating when people, for example, criticize Greta Thunberg from Sweden, who I guess we haven't heard as much recently of from because of the climate crisis, but COVID crisis. But last year was very much in the news. People criticize her for saying, oh, well, you know, she's taking a train or she's doing this and that, therefore she's using carbon. It's like, well, of course, the system inherently requires you. It's very difficult to be alive on this planet and not emit know, greenhouse gases in some kind of way. And no one's going to be perfect. But at the same time, you know, making these efforts and pushing in the right direction, it's always going to be baby steps. So we shouldn't let perfection get in the way of progress.
Definitely. In 2017, you were listed in Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30 in energy. What did it mean to you to be recognized for this honor?
Oh, you've done your research, haven't you, Devil? Okay, you've got popping all these facts from my history. It feels a while ago now. That was clearly like a big honor to have an organization like Forbes recognize the work that I've been doing. And to be honest, I would say the biggest thing that gave me was kind of a little bit of a opportunity to push forward. I think it was a sense of recognition that I could then utilize to get the things done that I wanted to. So kind of like a, yeah, I mean, it was a badge of honor that I could use and kind of drop into conversations if it was going to help me achieve what I was doing, because it was that level of recognition from a reputable organization. And actually after that, I wrote a sustainability column for Forbes as well, which was a fantastic opportunity just to reach, you know, I think one of my articles got over 100,000 views, which was just incredible. And so it gave me a platform just to reach far more people. I do have problems now that I think Forbes, unfortunately has far more climate change deniers writing for them than they do people talking about sustainability and climate change. I know they've made an effort to address this, but there's quite a lot of kind of fossil fuel industry lobbyists and people who are writing for them as well. So I'm no longer writing for them, but I wish they would kind of address that better. But at the same time, there was obviously an appetite for the things that I was writing about as well. And it was interesting because having such a big platform like that for writing for them, I would get the comments. I would get, you know, a whole range of people responding to my articles. And so, you know, for good and for worse. And it was surprising, kind of even writing things that I didn't think were particularly controversial, but just by using the word climate change, the people that would bring out of the woodwork who would literally just write me long abusive emails about how climate change doesn't exist and I'm getting money from George Soros or all these kind of conspiracy theories. And I was thinking, I wish I was getting paid for this. Like I wish, you know, people thought there was some kind of conspiracy and I was on the money, and like Forbes barely pays its contributors. So no, I wasn't. But yeah, anyway, it was interesting just to see kind of that breadth of conversation and being able to reach that level of people.
The science is straightforward, but it's amazing how many conspiracy terrorists there are out there and climate deniers.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting that those people have such a powerful voice when, you know, we have the scientists that are able to that are telling us what is going on, but yet we don't make progress because of these voices.
So James, what is your why? Why do you keep doing what you're doing? What keeps you motivated?
What keeps me motivated? I mean, I enjoy what I'm doing. I am very lucky that I get to wake up every day and do something that I believe in, which is, you know, definitely a privilege. I do really believe in this cause of sustainability and, you know, trying to do a little bit to make the world a better place. I just have a lot of motivation, and as you mentioned before, I do love to travel, or at least to experience new cultures and new people and learn from other people. And so it's amazing to be in this kind of opportunity where even now I'm not able to actually travel, but from my laptop today, I've already been to St. Helena, to Fiji, to Indonesia, and now to Trinidad in my conversations, which I think is pretty cool using Zoom. So that to me is fascinating, to just learn about the world. It really is interesting.
Yes, I'm really happy to be part of your amazing network. As I mentioned earlier, you were ahead of the curve as it relates to virtual connections. But what has the experience of COVID-19 taught you?
What has the experience of COVID-19 taught me? I guess the fragility of the world, you know. I think for young adapt, you know, we've lived through relatively good times for the past few decades. I mean, there's always been ups and downs, and maybe COVID, I mean, I don't think we've seen the worst of the impact. I just read the other day that the UK's economy has shrunk by 20% in the last couple of months, which is just unprecedented. And, you know, how quickly that recovery will be, I don't know. But I think there's some painful times ahead of us with the economic impacts, let alone all of the deaths and illness that's already been caused. So, I think it's been kind of a wake-up call to people about the fragility of the system. Unfortunately, I do think it's taken, you know, for obvious reasons, but it's taken the attention off other issues. And so thinking about it in a climate change context, clearly climate change is not going to go away. I think you can draw some parallels in terms of the differences, the similarities in terms of disruption. I mean, we saw the disruptions to supply chains that were happening during this crisis. I hope it's a wake-up call. So there's that element. On the flip side, you know, I already kind of knew this, that my whole team, I have a team of six people working for me at Island Innovation, and we were all in different countries anyway. So we had a fully virtual team and we were used to all this, but it's been good to see other people kind of wake up. And all change brings goods and bads. And I think if there's small good things that have come out of this crisis, it's been maybe that people have been forced to work differently. And I hope that will wake people up to the opportunities that arise as well.
Yes. So James, in closing, given that we, as you just mentioned, we are really facing a triple threat, the health pandemic, the economic decline, and the climate change crisis, what's next in sustainability?
What's next in sustainability? Wow, what a question. That's a big one. Okay, let me have a think. The thing is, for me, the solutions already exist. We hear about these amazing things happening, you know, with whatever Elon Musk is doing today, or these new inventions that are allowing us to do all these amazing things. But actually, the technology has existed for years. Mm-hmm. And the problem is normally policy and finance that gets in the way of actual implementation. So I'd like to see kind of a focus away from kind of the latest invention. When we have so many we do need to innovate. That's not to say we shouldn't keep innovating and improving technology and researching new technology, but there's so much out there that we can use already. And renewables is a great example of that. I think there are some issues around renewables that we need to address. And I think one of the problems is when there is kind of this fossil fuel lobby that is always out to get renewables, for want of a better word, people are sometimes reluctant to make critiques within the renewable energy community. But there are some serious issues we need to think about around what happens when solar panels or when batteries come to the end of their lifespan. We haven't really put enough effort into recycling, reusing, circular economy elements. Where are all the components for these tools coming from as well? You know, we're digging them up out of the ground, but what is the impact of those, particularly lithium? So there's some big conversations that do need to happen there. I'm excited. I'm currently working for a company called EnergyX, which is exploring how to secure lithium supplies. So lithium might seem kind of a really distant thing, and even in the renewable energy world, we don't think about it. But actually, it's vital for increasing renewables because you need batteries to store the energy. And so we've been working on how to actually make the extraction of lithium more sustainable and find ways of doing it better without the, you know, inevitable damage that comes from mining. So, you know, there's lots of rays of hope. We got to keep innovating, keep looking for new solutions. I do see a positive future, but I think renewables will be a part of that.
I sometimes worry that sustainability will take a hit as people focus on COVID and the economic recession. But I think the solution lies in, you know, bolstering sustainable systems. I know the UK is, there's talk, a lot of talk about the green recovery. So I think sustainability and things like renewable energy has to be central to the new normal. You have your summit that is coming up in September. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I hope all your listeners will join us at that. The Virtual Ireland Summit is happening from the 7th to the 13th of September this year. We're anticipating 10,000 stakeholders in total, which we're on track for, which is super exciting. And from really a really wide range of places, we'll be covering, it is very broad in terms of the topics. We're covering a whole range of sustainable development topic, but within the agenda, there'll be some very specific sessions on things like energy, tourism, waste management, education, healthcare, good governance, all of these issues that impact different islands in different ways. So yeah, we'd encourage everyone to go ahead and register. You can go to www.virtualislandsummit.com. Or just ask Derval for the website. She's involved with it. And it's free to register. So there's no excuse not to.
Exactly. So yeah, slide in my DMs if you need any more information. Or you can connect with James. Where can listeners connect with you on social networks?
I love Twitter. Twitter's my big one, but I also use LinkedIn and Facebook. So look me up, James Ellsmore. People always spell my last name wrong, so make sure you get it right. Ellsmoor. Yeah, feel free to connect with me.
Thank you so much, James.
Again, thanks so much for having me. It was fun to chat.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review, share with your friends, and follow the Climate Conscious Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thank you for listening. And remember, sustainability is the new normal.